Hey everyone, welcome to a brand new episode of the Vodka Clock Podcast. I'm your host, Amber Love, and you can support the show and my work by going to patreon.com/amberunmasked. And everything else is basically at amberunmasked.com. However, I am working on something new, but it's in progress and a little bit secret at the moment. Patreon backers know what it is, though. So you can also follow the daily adventures that me and the cats go through on Instagram at Amber Unmasked. So today I'm speaking with a dear friend of mine, my sister, essentially, as far as I'm concerned, from, gosh, over 20 years. Like, I don't even remember.
20 years.
Yeah. Over 20 years. And just to make it even more confusing, our names are almost the same. So Elizabeth Ann Burton Riley is here. We're going to talk about the importance of stories, collecting stories, oral histories. And since I write fiction and it's kind of like semi-fiction, we're going to talk about things like that, like how legends get started or whatever, and what her area of concentration is. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Yes. And she's moved about the country. So I actually did lose track of where you were. So you said you're in Michigan now?
Yes, I'm in Michigan. I've been in Michigan for the last couple of years.
Okay. And for those who might be new to the show, I'm in New Jersey, and that's where our adventures take place with Gus and Oliver, if you have not read our stories. But I highly encourage you to do so. And give me a little bit of your background, because obviously I was there in the trenches with you of struggling with crappy temp jobs just to do whatever it took to get through. And you eventually found your way into this high level of education and stuff. And kudos. So how did you get there? What are you working on?
Okay. All right. Yes. I have had a tremendous amount of crappy jobs. I just felt like throwing that out there.
Yes.
In 2013, I decided to go for a higher degree. Actually, I'm going to really backtrack, which has more to do with what we're talking about. When you and I pretty much first knew each other, I was working on a master's degree in folklore at the Union Institute and University and / Vermont College. At the time, they owned Vermont College, and I can't speak to that. I was there for about a year and a half, and due to a lot of things going on, I unfortunately had to drop out. And at the time, I was focusing on stories of fairies and little people and how that was universal. But what I did is I focused and did a compare and contrast between Cherokee stories of little people and the Irish stories of little people. So that's what I was working on pretty heavily. And life interceded. I had to leave. Fast forward to 2013, I wanted to complete my education, and I found a master's degree program at Plymouth State University in Plymouth, New Hampshire. And at the time, I was living in Albuquerque. That's a whole story in and of itself. But my husband and I, we keep moving to Albuquerque and then leaving. My mother's in Albuquerque anyway. So at the time I was there. So I applied for and I got accepted. And it was an interesting program because it's a master's degree in education, but the focus is heritage studies. So I thought, okay, I'm going to kind of revisit the folklore. So I got started in the program. We moved to New Hampshire. And then something awesome to me happened. Several awesome things happened. And one of which was the very, very first class I took in person was an ethnography course that focused on oral history. And I started realizing that everything I love was called oral history. I didn't even know the word for it at the time. So I really, really enjoyed it. And I started learning a lot about family oral histories and people and how they preserve knowledge through oral history. So while I was in that course, I actually did an extensive oral history study, which I believe I published, concerning a family friend who is Estonian, and she's an Estonian traditionalist. So she follows the old pre-Christian ways. So that kind of got me hooked. Another wonderful thing that happened to me is I wound up getting knee deep into Abenaki communities in New Hampshire. And I interned at the Mount Kearsarge Indian Museum. So I was working on oral history projects for the museum and for my own degree. So those two got me really deep and excited. So also at the same, it seems like everything happened in 2013. At the exact same time, I started really getting involved in my own family genealogy. And through that, I ended up meeting a whole lot of really wonderful people online, and people who self-identified as being Indigenous or mixed Indigenous, and all the complexities therein. So I wound up having a lot of very deep conversations with people concerning self-identifying as being Native American and not looking that way, so to speak. So all of that kind of was always in the back of my mind. So I got my master's degree and moved back to Albuquerque. And it was really interesting. Here I am with my master's degree. I come back to Albuquerque. The only job I found, administrative assistant.
Assistant, no. Yes, of course. No, like, can you put these alphabet things in order?
Oh, yeah, 100%. So it's kind of like, I always joked to people, you know, very biting humor that I have. I'm all like, you know what? I'm working on my PhD so I can become an office manager.
Of course.
So I worked at University of New Mexico, and that actually was really cool because it gave me an opportunity to take classes. So I applied for, got accepted in what's called, and this is a mouthful, Language Literacy and Social Cultural Studies, PhD program. My focus is more on the social cultural. It's an amazing program, and it's really kind of spread for different interests. Like half of my, well over half of my classmates are people from other countries who are in the program and getting their degree in ESL. So it's really fascinating, and it goes off in different directions. So I got accepted in that program, and I'm like, I want to focus on oral histories and Indigenous studies. And in a nutshell, that's what I'm doing. So I moved to Michigan to work with a tribe here that is not federally recognized, because what I'm really focusing also on is non-federally recognized tribal communities. How do they preserve their culture and language? How do they preserve all this without being federally recognized, with outsiders saying, well, you're not real or whatever? So I've actually been kind of doing some work with them, like genealogical, just kind of like historical work for years and years and years now, kind of online. So I'm here to be kind of in the thick of it. So that is, in a nutshell, my life.
how you got here.
How I got here.
And I mean, stories have obviously always been a love of yours. This I know, because I can remember you were the one who told me to read The Da Vinci Code, which I did. And then you told me to read The Handmaid's Tale, which I did. So, I mean, she was just like shoving books in my face here.
That's what I did.
It's fabulous. So stories have always been important. And as you said earlier, before we started, that your mom's a writer. And how, you know, with making these connections all through your family, and then through taking that to the outside world where you might be perceived as a foreigner, what's the difference in your experiences there asking people to talk about their lives? Some people just too, like, you know, you're super white and pink with red hair, like, you know, we don't want to talk to you, or is it just like, yes, we want people to know, here, let me unburden myself to you?
That is a fantastic question. Number one, that's never happened to me. I've never had that happen in terms of my whiteness. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm just saying that very specifically, I have to be blunt, specifically all the people that I've interviewed and done oral history stories and all that other stuff with look more like me. So that has never been really an issue. And also, to make a very long story short, I'm kind of an insider outsider. I share relatives with some of these communities. So, and, you know, on the, it's complicated. It's really like complicated because I enjoy being the outsider. I really do. I enjoy not being the story. I you know, there's like maybe a little journalist in me or something, because I enjoy, okay, you tell your story. I'm going to help you out with that, but I don't want to be the story. And that's actually come up majorly because part of my dissertation is I have to talk about me, and I hate that, you know, but it is very important because I have to talk about my own perspective on this topic. So I feel like
that's interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've always been like really weird about that, but that's a me thing because I am interested in other people's stories. I'm not interested in my story.
A lot of my more modern information has been coming through Twitter, for good or for bad. It really depends on who you follow. You know, because algorithms are side. You know, it's. You can still kind of figure out, you know, do a little experiment, make one account, follow one kind of, you know, one certain type of person, and then make up a second account and follow different kinds of people, and you'll see the difference. So with the Indigenous people that I've been following, different kinds of writers, people who are activists. I mean, I don't know if that's their day job or what it is. But I just see them online as activists. Mm-hmm. And as you said, do you get to choose your identity? Because we, not just we in the United States, but also Canada and probably elsewhere, some people are just learning about things that their governments did and they didn't know before. Like, you know, right now Ukraine is going through a genocide because of Putin and Russia. And for people, like, literally go look up the definition of genocide, and you will see that it doesn't just mean mass slaughter. It means taking away people's language, taking away their way of life, so when the Indigenous populations of North America have the right to, you know, they have the right to maintain their ways because their languages, like you said, were so many of them are lost. When they were pushed out of land and conglomerated, they had to just find themselves combining with other tribes that might not have had anything to do with them. So it's very weird. So then there were the children being stolen. You're not a good enough parent. We're stealing your children. We're putting them in resident schools and they're never going to be allowed to speak the language. They're never going to be allowed to celebrate your holidays or however you do things. And they're going to dress like we do. And so that was Canada and the United States for sure. So now, decades later, hundreds of years later, it's this empowering of people being allowed to self-identify and not worrying about, oh, it was my, you know, one eighth of parental genealogy blood quantum thing and I'm allowed to call myself something. So a lot of people aren't finding these identities until later in life.
That's
and
true.
They, you know, they have to, I imagine, not just have a lot of work to, like, self healing and self work to get through, but you have to deal then with the people outside of you, like, you know, people filling out forms, like, You know, checking off that box. Hey, I turns out I'm indigenous. And don't honestly don't base everything on the ancestry tests, because I mean, they're flooded with databases built off of white people. So the more diverse they get, the better their results will be.
Yeah.
But at the start, they, you know, everybody was coming back as like, you know, like if an Indian person from, I mean, India, if they took the test, they were, you know, there's like, you know, billion of them. And it was coming back as just like general South Asia, you know?
Yeah,
like,
no, you know. I agree. Yes.
Yeah, so, so these, the blood quantum problems and the loss of heritage can be really seen as a struggle. And I see this on Twitter, as I was saying, mm-hmm. I see people speaking out. And like when in the US, when we do the Electoral College, and every once in a while you get to hear a different language.
Yeah.
And somebody said, I got to hear my language said for the first time. And it was just like,
so beautiful.
And it was just like, how amazing is that? All because a representative ran and won. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, and now thankfully we have somebody responsible in charge of Interior mm-hmm. as opposed to an oil magnet, you know.
I know, no lie. You're bringing up a whole lot of excellent points that I've been struggling with in my research, because there are like a lot more than two sides to this, but there are like, for lack of a better term, there's two camps. And there are people who find out that, especially as adults, or even grow up with, oh, wow, you have indigenous blood, you have these indigenous things, and they embrace that, and they're part of the community and everything else. You also have people who exploit it like crazy and say, oh, yeah, I'm just going to say I'm blah without any proof whatsoever. And so you have those kind of like two factions, and it's brutal. I mean, I do not want to get involved in this controversy. When I was writing for my exams, which is part of my dissertation, I'm literally saying this paper, my dissertation, is not going to deal with who is what. I mean, in terms of that, I am not going to take a DNA test of the people I interview. If they say they're indigenous, I'm going to take them at face value. I'm going to do the work. And mm-hmm. I'm not there to judge, but right. there is backlash with both. There are communities and indigenous people that are getting horrifically exploited by this, and people trying to take that slot, take that check mark and have, you know, through affirmative action or whatever, you know, what have you. And then there's also the side of people saying, no, this is who I am. This is who my family is. And, you know, having a massive backlash. I mean, just like, is so huge that, you know, I fall off the floor, that people, you know, 8 ways from Sunday go, you know, really, I've proven this, and still they've lost their jobs, they've lost their careers, they've lost everything, especially in academia. You just don't, you know, you can talk about right. the topic, but, you know, so there is a huge controversy, and I'm trying to be honest with you, as sensitive as humanly possible, and go, you know, to both sides and say, I don't want to deal with people who are exploiting the system / I don't want to be the one making that judgment. I don't think I have the right, you know, mm-hmm. personally, I don't think I have the right to come up to anybody and say, well, you know, you're not fill in the blank, you right. know? And so, but it leaves me in this kind of precarious position, because my whole focus is, you say you are fill in the blank. How does that make you feel? I mean, not in a psychology sort of way, but say, okay, you say you're indigenous. I'm not saying yay or nay, but you say you're indigenous. Okay, so do you speak the language? Do you want to learn the language? Have you and your family tried to retain the culture? What is that like? You know, I'm asking questions more like that than challenging any identities. You know, mm-hmm. so it's like I'm knee deep in this huge controversy that I'm like hiding under the desk as I'm writing. You know?
Can so you Well, can you explain the difference? Like, how, why would one tribe be recognized and one, you know, whereas other ones aren't? Because there's like over 800 or something in the United States.
It's 500 and some odd. Something. No, wait a minute. Yeah. I could be totally wrong. And I'm so sorry. I don't have that in front
but,
of me.
Yeah.
This sounds like a silly thing to say, but I don't work with federally recognized tribes. So I totally forget.
Right.
That is a complex answer, my friend. Okay. Let me see if I can dig into it a teeny tiny bit. Teeny tiny bit is my personal focus. So this is kind of like my myopic lens. My myopic lens is Northeast Woodlands, period. And like the tribe that I'm working with here in Michigan, that's part of it. Northeast Woodlands consists of people who are either Iroquoian or Algonquian speaking for the most part. I mean, that's a big, broad terminology. These people have had contact with white people and have been, you know, freaking exterminated and married into, and you fill in the blank, since the early 1600s. So it's a totally different narrative than, say, the Lakota or the Navajo.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, you know, you got that East Coast, you know,
East Coast
trauma. Yes. This is where people landed.
Exactly. Like, and so that type of intermarriage and that type of experiences, as it were, have been going around a heck of a lot longer. So it's a very kind of a different narrative, if that makes any sense. So to answer your question about federal recognition, all of that being said, I mean, the Wampanoag are federally recognized. Tribes in Connecticut are federally recognized. So I think, and again, I apologize, I am so not an expert, so you might want to edit this part out, but I think it has to do with treaties. Bottom line, it's treaties. Did these people sign in a treaty with the United States? Were they in that agreement? So the tribe that I'm working with out here is kind of a good example because they actually stem from several tribes. It's more of like a confederacy, for lack of a better term, of different communities coming together. We're talking like since the 16, actually technically way before then. So they were originally in Ontario, Canada, and they merged with people who were originally here in the Midwest. And so, how do I explain this? There was a lot of movement around, and they had forced left to go to Kansas, forced left to go to Oklahoma. The people in Oklahoma are federally recognized, the people here and the people in Kansas are not. So it's kind of like the people who did the walk and signed the treaties and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, who went to Oklahoma are federally recognized. But the families that, let's be honest, by that point, it probably married in, hid out, or whatever, white coated by this point, that stuck around, they did not sign a specific piece of paper. So their descendants are not federally recognized. Again, these are some pretty broad statements I'm making.
Yeah, no, I understand. Because I mean, like you said, you're seeking, you know, like PhD, you know, candidacy in this. So this is not something we can cover in an hour, but I was curious to know, like, why was it just like, no, you count, but you don't. And I didn't.
I kind of want to also go way backwards into a totally different topic, but it's not, which is in the 1980s, way backwards in the 1980s. I was involved with and friends with a lot of different communities that Wicca, pagan, all this. And the narrative that I heard over and over and over again were people saying, well, I'm hereditary. My family has brought this down through my family. These are the traditional pre-Christian traditions. And other people saying to them, oh, you're full of it. Oh, no way could that be possible. So that, in a very strange way, that's how it got me started. That in the 1980s made me wake up and go, wait a minute. You know, and the people who deal with this backlash, people who hundreds of years have been Christianized and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, have held on to this. How do they do it? And what does that mean? So I'm kind of many moons later here in 2022, getting my dissertation, strangely trying to answer that question. It's a very broad question. And of course, in my dissertation, all I'm going to do, I'm going to be interviewing like four people and say, okay, this is how these four people do it. you know, and I could talk in broad terms, these different communities. Like I'm also going to be discussing the Abenaki people in New Hampshire and Vermont. I'm not going to be interviewing them, but there are certain communities that I go, hey, bam, these communities have preserved their language, preserved their culture. And you know, these are kind of different examples. So, but I just wanted to give you an idea of what the heck got me into this in the first place.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting root origin story for you and how you got there. And like we both have in common is just our own names have like given us this, exactly. You know, inherent need to just claim our own like name, like just
exactly.
Everybody should just be allowed to change their name like free of charge at some point. Like give us like a token limit, like give us, you can change your name, you know, marriage, divorce, whatever. And also when you hit 30, I mean, like,
I love that. And that goes to identity. That goes to, this is who I am and how I choose to show myself to the world. And I love what you just said. Ironically, when I was divorced from my first marriage, for various reasons, my name change wasn't in there. So I shelled out like hundreds of dollars. I actually went to a court and said, hi, I want to change my last name to blah. You know, and so it was really kind of interesting that you say that. It's like when you turn 30, I love that.
And it was, you know, I remember when you were doing that and like you wanted to take your mother's name and they wouldn't let you. Wasn't that it? Or wanted to take?
Well, it's not a matter of wouldn't let me, but you're actually pretty close because again, I knew I was going through a divorce. And while I was going through a divorce, I was looking at various last names in my family tree. And mm-hmm. I was originally focused on some of the names from my mother's side of the family. So, no, you're totally right. Yeah. And then I was looking at both sides of the tree. And then on my father's side, I had an ancestor named Elizabeth Riley. And it was really kind of interesting because I'm not even kidding you. I can't believe I'm just going to like publicize this story, but here it goes. I'm not even kidding you, but I glanced at the name. We're talking like I didn't give it a second thought. And then I had a dream. That night, I had a dream that I was on a bus in Albuquerque. And at the time, I was living in New Mexico, northern New Mexico. And it was the middle of the night. I got off the bus. And I left my backpack. I left my purse basically on the bus. And I said out loud, oh my God, I've lost my identity. And there was this voice that said to me, you're going to be okay because you're going to start your life over as a Riley. And I went, really? And I woke up and that's when I picked the name. That's when I went, okay, I'm starting my life over as a Riley. So, and again, when my husband and I, when we first got together and he was all like, I want to take your name. And then I'm all like, well, I like your name. So we both like decided to take both of our names. And, you know, and again, I decided to take his name, not legally, by the way, I have no paperwork. This is just in my head. You know? So I kind of take his last name as part of my middle name. But that's how that happens. So it's like, I'm always kind of looking into that and going back to like paganism and these communities and these stories. Another thing, because I grew up in Los Angeles. So there I am in Los Angeles. And by the way, I'm saying this without any whatever, you know, but I'm in Los Angeles and I'm with a community of people. And we're doing these, you know, ceremonies that are traditional to Northern Europe. So I'm in Los Angeles, it's 110 degrees, and I'm doing a ceremony that's appropriate when it's very much not that. And so, and I remember at this moment standing there thinking, wait a minute, it's like, this feels inappropriate to me, and I'm not judging or anything without judgment, but this feels inappropriate, this feels weird to me. And then I thought, well, what if I did a ceremony of the indigenous people of California? I'm like, that definitely feels inappropriate to me. That's like not my thing either. So then it was like the wheels started turning literally at that moment. I remember standing there in the desert going, this is interesting, you know, and the wheels started turning. And it's been that, you know, so when I was studying about the fairies in, you know, in Ireland, the Cherokee and all over the place, to me, that was my it. That was my like, okay, this is freaking universal. You can find stories, little people, magical little people all over the planet. I'm going to use that topic to, you know, investigate how people hold on to the old ways. Because so many of those stories of the little people tie into the old ways, you know, all over the world. And it's really amazing. And then I hit a massive roadblock, not only the roadblock of, you know, personal life, why I had to leave that school, but it was a roadblock whenever I asked a traditional person, tell me about the little people. They said, no. I'm like, oh, no. They said, no, you're allowed to use information from books, but you can't interview. No, no, no. This is private. This is sacred. I went, oh, boy. And I respect that, by the way. I like wholeheartedly, but I had to like dump the entire idea, you know? And every so often my mother gets up, oh, you should write about the little, oh, okay, not the way I want to. And then I roll my, but I totally respect it too. And I honor that, but that's why I stop with that topic. I'm like, okay, I don't want to get in trouble with spirits or people. Or
yeah, right. Like all of a sudden there's, you know, you find your jewelry missing piece by piece.
I know, this is what I'm saying to you, you know, so of course I decide on identity, which is far more of an explosive topic,
you know, it really, it is. And it's not just a matter of like your subject where you're working with Indigenous people. This is something that the trans community is battling.
I think about that a lot. Yep.
And, you know, Black identities they go through
exactly
as well. And then of course you have just you know, like one of my other writer friends is Korean, but he was adopted as baby, so you know, it took him a long time to understand his own roots. And luckily he wasn't alone, he had two brothers, they're triplets, and they were all adopted together. But for, you know, there's a lot of Asian adoption in the U.S. For a while there, it was always like Slavic areas. And then I don't know if it became like a cost thing, like white babies cost too much, but probably. Then, you know, it just seemed like adoption all changed to be Asian babies or even worse, taking advantage of other people, taking advantage of other people and say, you know, if you go to their country and say, well, you know, I'll give you $20,000 for your baby and they'll live a great life, you know, and you know, you're a celebrity and suddenly you have 8 adopted babies. And that's great they give them homes and they raise them and hopefully they get to keep some of their culture, but you don't know. You could have a creepy father like Woody Allen. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Isn't it disgusting?
Absolutely. Yeah. absolutely. And just add, you know, in really quick, my favorite book. See, here I am giving you books again. This is the kind of
course.
My favorite book on my topic, you know, in terms of mixed blood, Indigenous identity and learning about that. The best book I've ever read in my life is Scott Lyons' X/MARKS. So Scott Lyons, I just love him. Now, he also wrote another book called The Word and the Text, but X Marks says everything that I'm trying to say, but he says it 10 times better. I quote him a lot. And it is just, he really digs into it and digs into blood quantum and digs into being white coded and digs into culture and language. And it's just, he does a better job than I do. But I just wanted to kind of mention Scott Lyons because I'm like, you know what? I'm going to take this opportunity because he's amazing. So I love that book. Anyways.
Did you ever read or watch Longmire? It's based on a series of novels. So, but I've watched it. I haven't read
really?
It. But I loved the show a lot. Some of it got a little sidetracked with one character, but it's interesting that I was talking to another friend and he said that he actually didn't like the show because he read the books. But they, because it's very much about, it's in Wyoming, so it's really about tribal police versus, you know, local sheriff and corruption on both sides. Because you got like big white land developers, and then you've got, you know, indigenous casino owners, and, you know, and they, their own security and stuff like that. So there's a lot of corruption and of course drug problems going back and forth because it's a crime drama. So they did tackle things like domestic violence, and it was, the show did get like seriously deep at some point. And but there was always, at least in the show, I don't know about the books, a little like a tug of war between this character, Jacob Nighthorse, and people who are quote unquote full blood or whatever. Because he became the spokesman, you know, to represent the tribe, like a tribal president or something. And so he was always the one that was forefront and center, and the one to, you know, always go against whatever the white people would, you know, propose. And they did have a very similar case to, which is obviously not the first time, but something that's very recent in our lives and still present. It wasn't COVID, but it was Indigenous parents who didn't want white medicine to treat their child, even though it was something that was known, and all it would take would be one injection and the child would have been fine. And they just didn't trust white medicine for good reason. So it was this, it was a really heartbreaking thing, because you can understand, like, don't you want to save your child's life? And it's like, we don't trust you. We never will. Stop, you know, just stop. And, so again, it was a situation where the kid was, you know, basically kidnapped to get, in order to give him or her this shot. And I mean, we, like I said, we go through that with COVID and sterilization. Like now we not only have like, you know, no more Roe versus Wade to back us up, but, people have been talking about forced sterilization on certain populations, and other people, like, this is brand new information. They did not know this. But there was an episode on Longmire about the forced sterilization that had been going on. So, so it was strange to say that I learned a lot from a fictional crime drama, but I did. And, it's just, it touches upon, you know, what you're saying about these tribes that are not recognized and that people have the right to self-identify. And hey, in their own personal lives, they might be getting a lot of pushback about this new information that they didn't have before. Because, you know, just like, I mean, people will rag on Elizabeth Warren from now until the end of time. I mean, it's in the history books. It's just going to be that way. But when you take something that your parents and grandparents tell you and you believe it, I mean, fuck, I believed in Santa Claus. Like, you know, I mean, it's like your parents tell you these stories and you don't know that your parents are exaggerating. Like, I can remember for how many years my father told me I caught the biggest fish in the lake and thought I really caught the biggest fish in the lake. And it was like a 6-inch catfish. I mean, it was something stupid.
You cracked him. There's so much to unpack with that. I mean, and again, not an expert. From what I read about Elizabeth Warren, and I might not be an expert in this either, a couple of things. One, she did do a DNA test. And yeah, she does have traces of Native American. So yeah, she wasn't completely full of it. B, when, if I remember correctly, when Harvard hired her, she's like, oh yeah, I was just like, well, you know, do you, are you, you know, what race or whatever? And she, it seemed like a flipping, you know, I have some ancestors that are Cherokee. They ran with it, not her. So, and then she got the backlash from that. So I, again, I could be wrong with that. And that's just kind of what I've read. But a lot of what you're saying, you know, rings a lot of truth. And of course, there could be exaggerations and everything else. A lot of the case is kind of the opposite. A lot of the cases, most generations, you didn't talk about this. This was a shameful thing. This was like, no way. And, you know, some of the stuff that I've talked to, I mean, it was, you know, both the tribe I worked with and other people I've interviewed, this was something that was whispered about. This is not like, oh, look at me, I'm a Cherokee princess. It's more of like, you know, don't talk about it. We don't want bad things to happen. I mean, it was completely, so that's kind of a different generational thing. Like now it's like, oh, wow, it's so cool. Or in the 60s, it might've been considered cool with some subcultures, but for a huge amount of people, it was kind of the opposite, you know? I mean, originally, it was like, no, we're white. And, you know, and if you look like you were white, that's the other thing is kind of doing genealogy. And I've seen census records where somebody, I'm not even kidding, somebody is white, their whole family is white, and like one of the census records 10 years later they're native, 10 years after that they're white again, and you know, and it's like, I give up. So people are very, very strict about documentation. Well, I want to have, you know what, rightfully so, and that's cool, but I have seen documents that were totally messed up, you know, that I just go,
yes,
and I just throw my hands up in the air at that point. So it's weird. And there's also been like, it's really kind of funny because there's also been this thing, well, you know, nobody says that they have or really pursues African blood descent. You know, they just focus on, oh, you know, I'm this Cherokee princess or whatever. There's a lot of truth to that too. But I also have friends who are also focusing on, you know, having an African descent from many years ago and trying to kind of unpack that with their genealogical tree too. So I don't know. I'm on a tangent.
No, but this is, this is a conversation. This is what we do.
That's
this
pretty good. Because I feel like I'm just like, I don't know, read, you know, Scott Lyons, you watch.
Yes.
Yeah. I eloquent. I'll put it that way. And again, I'm kind of unpacking a lot of things and I'm trying to stay away from controversy at the same time. So I'm like, I feel like I'm dancing on the edge of a cliff, you know, like the Fool card in tarot, you know, in a sense that I want to talk about very specific. I want to talk about meaning making and identity and cultural and language preservation without having to go into the massive controversies and the exploitation that definitely does happen too, and this and that, and who are you and everything else. But it's been a challenge. So I just try to focus on my work, honestly, and focus on people that I interview. So speaking of which, you know, my official interviews will not be occurring until I pass my proposal, and then I have to do the IRB. And that's the, you know, Institutional Review Board saying, okay, we love you. We think you're groovy. They don't say that. You know, they give me permission to interview. So it's like, I've done a whole lot of interviewing for like, you know, classes and helping people out. But my official ones are not going to be until late fall, early winter, knock on wood. I pass all that. So.
Right. And I'm sure COVID, you know, threw a monkey wrench into it
did.
As well.
It did. And yet on the flip side, I mean, it was kind of a mixed bag on a very selfish note, by the way. This is me being totally selfish. On the one hand, it threw a monkey wrench because any kind of tribal get together or any get togethers was gone. But on the other hand, everybody's doing Zoom and that's helping me because,
exactly.
You know, I was able to kind of interview and, you know, not so much interview, but really work with people while I was still in New Mexico before I came out here. So in that sense, I'm like, well, trying to make lemons out of lemonade.
Yeah. Made things a little bit more accessible. Well, a lot more accessible in some cases, as long as the technology was there.
Exactly.
So aside from Scott Lyons' nonfiction work, do you have...
Oh, it's all nonfiction. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt. No, I hardly ever read fiction. I'm sorry. Go on.
Yeah. So what I was going to ask was with, you know, obviously without outing anyone or violating anyone's trust or anything, is there a favorite story that somebody has told you?
Wow.
like, you know, because I know, I know, like you said, you're very emotional and empathetic, and so, you know, just like me. So, if there was a story that stuck out and was just like, grabbed you right in the heart.
Wow. I'm trying to give me a second to think about that. One of the stories, and it doesn't have to do with this. I mean, weirdly enough, and going back to the Estonian traditionalist,
because
in a way, I am actually so inspired by her that it kind of led to a lot of this journey. She had talked about, interesting story. She's in her 80s. And she was there, she was in Estonia in World War II, and she lived in the camps, the American camps, and all that kind of goes with that, and all the tragedies that kind of go with that. And her mother was a traditionalist, and her mother's father was a traditionalist. And, you know, it was little tiny things like you cut down a tree, you plant three. And I mean, just little things like that, and giving thanks all the time, and all of these very strong traditional ways, and keeping that language. I mean, Estonian, it's not like it's a lost language for Pete's sake, but in wartime, we're talking like in freaking wartime, and holding on to those traditions. And she and her family ended up moving to the United States when she was little, in the, I believe, 1940s. So, but it was those little traditions, again, giving thanks and replanting a tree and having the birch tree as unbelievably sacred to them, you know, and thank God birch grows incredibly well, but using the birch oils and saunas, which are essentially sweat lodges, and, you know, it just kind of, you know, holding on to that. And that really got to me. I mean, that passing down of information and that tradition, literally during a war, and during like when the Russians and the Germans, all these people were just decimating their culture, you know, to be able to hold on to that, those pieces, and be able to be blunt, pass them down. That, you know, in a very strange way, and it's weird that, you know, I'm using this as the example, but that's also kind of inspired my work, and saying, hey, how are these communities doing it? You know,
I think it's brilliant. I mean, you know, because it's probably somewhere in the back of your brain and not even being aware of it, but we all, you know, we all grew up, I think, at least in our age, of having to read Anne Frank's diary. You know, like there were certain things that, you know, we just had to consume. And the fact that there's just like people that exist who will always grasp onto any conspiracy, no matter how hurtful. Saying things didn't happen, or they weren't that bad, or that number is exaggerated.
I know.
There's nothing like that.
I mean, watching it right now. I mean,
it's horrible.
I know.
I can remember specifically, I don't remember what grade, but I think it was 10th grade, being in high school history class. And, you know, again, talking about World War II, and I said something like, oh God, we would never do something like that. Who even thinks of this? And the teacher just looked at me and went, but we did. I was like, what now? You know? What? And that's when I heard about the internment camps, and you know, and let me just say, like, you're not stupid if you weren't taught something. Okay.
Exactly.
You just, the people giving you information, just either you didn't retain it, or they were given wrong information. I can remember one of my professors who was, you know, very old, completely confusing the Axis and Allied powers. And
I was just not good. I'm sorry.
I was just like, which one do I put down on the exam? Like, which, you know, it's like,
That's pretty bad.
Yeah. Just the terminology alone. So I was just like, oh no, what am I going to do on this exam? It's never too late to learn something, even if it's something shitty about your own people. Like, you know,
I know.
I mean, hey, I am literally the representative of the Karens. I'm the white middle-aged woman. We did nothing but fuck up for, you know, for decades, and get a lot of credit, you know, when Black women do a lot of the work. So, you know, especially politically speaking, I mean, it's just, there's just so much. And if it, you know, I haven't watched it yet, but I just heard about a Netflix documentary called like Black and Missing, I think.
Yes. I think that's the name. I think so.
And so I just heard about it listening to my favorite murder podcast. What they bring up is, you know, oh, when a white female subject is kidnapped or disappears or murdered, it's a big thing and it becomes like historical, like the Madeleine McCann thing. Oh my God, they're still airing things about Madeleine McCann and JonBenet Ramsey.
I know.
And yet this happens to little girls of color and boys and trans kids all the time. And
all the time.
So it's just a matter of who gets the headline and why. And I realize the resources are different now. So thankful for these organizations who can do that. And you can maybe get your own stuff out there on the social networks to help find missing people or get answers. And there's a whole, you know, online community of people who try to solve cold cases through
podcasts. I know. And there's also missing and murdered Indigenous women.
Indigenous women, right.
Yeah, of Canada and the United States, which is just the most disturbing amount of these women and girls, and a lot of times men and boys that poof. Right. And you're absolutely right. I mean, my goal, like my life goal, one of my life goals is to try to be the best ally I can be, you know, and because of my deep, passionate love of oral history, my goal is also to kind of put the best light on, like help people tell their stories, you know, in a very positive, very empowering way. You know, I'm hoping that with my dissertation and my work and et cetera, that it'll empower people. I want people to feel good. You know, it's kind of like there's a part of me, and I've read this a lot about journalists and oral historians are kind of like kissing cousins, you know, a journalist's job is to get to the truth. And I love journalism. I mean, I think it's amazing. And oral history is a little bit more like, what is their truth? You know, and there are some definite, you know, differences and similarities, but you know, that kind of ties into that. It's like, I want to be the best ally I could be. And my way of trying to do that is to do oral history interviews, to write and you know, that sort of thing. So
I think that's important. I think preserving what we can is going to be important. And you never know, because just the way of the earth or the planet, and you know, records get destroyed. I mean, it gets destroyed. It's, I can't remember. Somebody was just talking about how there was something, some sacred site that was like uncovered in I want to say either England or Ireland. That, you know, the only reason it was found is because I think people were going to like develop or something.
Yeah, that a lot of times that happens. Yeah.
You know, at least over here when that happens, construction has to halt. So I can't speak for other places, but at least here, again, something I learned from watching Murder, She Wrote, you know, even if it's a hoax, even if you take, and Parks and Rec did a satire on this too. They took, you know, they planted artifacts. Pawnee artifacts. That was, you know, because Parks and Rec, that's what they did, was they held the mirror up. So, but yeah, Murder, She Wrote, like there's a architecture dig, condos going up, and then they find a skeleton and it's like, whoa, what's the historical significance of the skeleton? And, you know, so
there you go. NAGPRA. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's amazing that we can learn certain things that actually are not complete bullshit.
Yeah, that's always a good thing. Absolutely. That you crack me up. No, absolutely. That's very well put.
Well, I mean, and you can even learn from, you know, futuristic stuff. Going on to like Star Trek. Like, I mean, I remember talking about Star Trek and
I'm such a geek. So now you're talking my language.
Yeah.
Well, next generation Voyager geek, you know.
But yeah. But that's what I mean. You know, you come across, you know, everything was put in as a metaphor, you know, and
it is. And going back to that, and going back to storytelling, I mean, actual storytelling. I mean, I consider myself like a story collector. You know, I'm a terrible storyteller. I've been told that I can't tell a joke because, you know, I don't do the punchline right or whatever. But, you know, you have these like universal truths and a lot of times, you know, Star Trek. And a weird example for me is the Terminator. And to me, the Terminator is a huge example. I mean, you either get it or you don't. And and a lot like, you know, and the Terminator is based on a lot of old stories. And it's like, you take this sci-fi, Arnold Schwarzenegger and everything else, but you also have this deeper narrative of the sun lover goddess whole thing about, you know, she meets, you know, essentially the god, he gets her pregnant, she has the baby, and that baby grows up, he becomes the god. I mean, there's a lot of depth to, I'm a big fan, you know, of Terminator that has that like underlining mythology to it. I'm getting all Joseph Campbell on you now, but you know,
but it's awesome.
You do learn a lot from a lot of these stories, a lot of these, and they become the, well, you know, going back to Next Generation, it was really powerful that there was Christie's many, many years ago. Christie's in, I think, England or something, did this auction of items from Next Generation. It was this massive thing. And one guy, all he said was, I bought the flute, and I started crying. And then he's like, yeah, everybody I told this to cried because it tapped into this beautiful episode called The Inner Light, where Picard lived this totally different life. He had a wife, he had children, he had grandchildren, and lived this entire existence. Yeah, you know, and at the very, very end of this existence, they're like, yeah, we want you to tell our story. So you lived our story. And he had this flute throughout this entire existence. So, I mean, I'm like bawling. I was like, oh yeah, the flute, you know, because it was like, to me, that was the symbolic representation of living this mythology. So, but that's my little story.
But the idea of passing down stories is, it's even written into as like, you know, as the bard, like, 300, like, I don't know, crap of the history of 300, but the Spartans, the Spartans, and all
I
that
ignore the Greco-Roman.
So it's so it was one of those things where like, this one guy survived and he's like, what am I supposed to do? And he's like, you're supposed to walk back and tell people what just happened.
Yeah, that's true.
And so, and then the same things I think happened in Lord of the Rings. Didn't like Faramir like have to didn't Faramir get sent back to share the stories? And so so there will always be somebody sent back to share the stories. So I think it's
exactly,
it's cool if you feel that passion. And
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But so is there anything that you want to share? Plug your mom's book if you want.
Oh, really? Okay. My mother is Judy Wilmore. You can put a little hashtag. Anyways, although she's no longer on Twitter, I try to, it's a long story. She's a little older. So she's all like, Twitter's what? And I'm like, that's my okay. My mother wrote an absolutely brilliant novel called The Menagerie, and it is set in Versailles, and it is with the Sun King Louis, and it is a murder mystery. It's about the poison. You have to read it, honey. It is about it's about the poisons that went on, and it's filled with intrigue, and it's just wonderfully written. So what it is, it's really kind of neat. So she wrote this book, and now she's doing book two. Like the first book She was just knee deep. I mean, it took her well over 10 years to write this book because she did a tremendous amount of scholarly research and she speaks French. So, I mean, she's reading French documents in French and doing all the, I mean, just an incredible amount of work. So it is historical fiction in the truest sense of the word. And right now she's writing book two, where she's getting kind of away from the quote unquote historical fiction. And she's also bringing in a woman who is, I believe she decided is Abenaki. They're Mi'kmaq or Abenaki, because a lot of, kind of going back to my own research in the 1600s, children of these communities, these native children of these communities in Quebec, would become Christianized. And a lot of them were sent to France to become educated and sent back. And there are stories and legends, I haven't proved or disproved, I'm not a historian. There are stories and legends that when they were sent back, they are shown up as white. They're shown up as French in genealogical records. So, because they lost their name completely. But anyhow, so my mother is writing about one such young lady who was in Versailles. And she, and so there's a, this is all fiction, not so much historical. I don't know who knows, it could be, but she's friends with one of my mother's major characters from the first book, a young lady by the name of Sylvie. And some of the first book goes into Sylvie's story on how she's kind of watching this corruption and all this other stuff. And her second book that she's writing is about tapestries, actually, and the people who make the tapestries. And there's some kind of poison and murder, I know not what, because I haven't read it yet. So, but her first book, you can get it on Amazon, Google Judy Wilmore, and Amazon, and I believe her local, it's really cool, a local bookstore in Albuquerque sells it. I forgot the name. Her publisher sells it. I forgot their name. But it's if you want, I can send you links to all that. No, she's a really, really good writer, and she happens to be an amazing editor, and she's saved my butt from the fire. I got to be honest. Through my graduate studies, she has really helped edit my papers. I mean, I owe her a debt of gratitude for that. So
that's so cool.
So that is, she helped me buy my iPad, which may sound like an odd thing to say, but I'm actually thinking about writing an article about my iPad, because as an oral historian and a PhD student, I'm learning about all these new tricks and tips by using my iPad to do all this stuff, that I'm thinking about writing about that. So my iPad is it's really, because right now I've been working on a project where I have tons of notebooks that I need in text, and I've been working on that. And that's what I've been doing through my iPad and my iMac and through a program that, for some reason, I totally forgot the name of. For $12.99, I'm able to convert the handwriting into text and the text and clean it up, because a lot of these notebooks I'm using as data points to my work. So I can be able to literally run searches of different keywords and how often those keywords show up. So I've been thinking about writing about that, actually, little technology thing. So
I think that's great. I mean, I use Duolingo to do little lessons every day. So I do little.
Me too. Yep.
So I'm mainly doing French and Spanish. French I did take in high school. So it looks like I'm like skyrocketing through it. And it's like, well, it's really a lot of like buried somewhere in those gray cells type stuff. Spanish is pretty new. But I also activated, just to try to see what it was like, the Haitian Creole part. And that's new. It's in beta. So they don't have all of the same things, but it's interesting how much more Haitian Creole makes sense as a language than actual formal French.
So cool.
They do have one Native American language in there, but I can't remember off the top of my head which one.
I think they do. Absolutely. And I got to look into that. But right now I'm just so knee deep. But I did use Duolingo a couple of years ago. I was trying to learn French and I want to get back into that. It's just, I've been too busy, because a lot of my research is Quebec French records. I mean, like, I'm looking at all these records and I'm saying, oi, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And it was another writer who told me that, like, Quebecois or Quebecois, however you say it, is not like French, is not like a person, because they read it in like a comic or something, and they read the, you know, somebody put like a French translation, and they're just like, that's not what somebody in Canada would say.
Exactly. I mean, it is French, but it's kind of like saying, like, yeah, it is different. I mean, it's like in northern New Mexico, the Spanish that they speak is different than in Spain, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's still Spanish, it's still French, but it is a very different.
Yeah,
and you're absolutely right, because in Duolingo, if I remember, you can take Quebecois French or French for France, you know? Yes. It's one of those programs. So I'm like, yeah. So yeah. I think it's the other one, but I don't remember.
Rosetta, or maybe, who knows?
Rosetta, I think that is it. Anywho, I gotta eat lunch, my friend.
Yes. So thank you so much. Thank you so much for talking to us today. I will let you go. Thank you guys for listening. You can check out the show notes and everything at amberunmasked.com. Don't forget that you can also support my work anyway at patreon.com/amberunmasked. All right.